Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting and video streaming live from our studios in New York City. You can watch today's program by going to ustream.tv and searching for Gary Null. Also, we have tens of thousands of people spending over 10 million minutes listening to this program all over Canada and the United States by telephone. Please write down the number. You never know when your local affiliate, where carried on many stations, might drop the program or might have a difficulty one day, in which case, not a problem. You just go over to a phone number, dial in, and you can hear it. I'm going to give you two numbers. I have to give you two because we have so many people listening, one may be full. Here are the numbers you can listen to my program on. 712-432-7231. That's 712-432-7231. The other number is 401-347-0456. That's 401-347-0456. We call this the Talkback Hour because during this hour, you'll have an opportunity to call in with your questions, comments, challenges, anything that empowers us. Give us a call. That number, 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. I like to share a lot of health and nutrition during this hour. A more in-depth classroom on the air today about protecting your bones and your arteries with vitamin K2. Also, the apple's going to have to share some space with the peach because there's brand new research I'm going to share with you about how peaches are protecting people in a major way from breast cancer and metastasized cancer. Also, how fish oil is protecting the brain after strokes, how mulberry leaf lowers triglycerides, the bad LDL cholesterols, and turns off C-reactive protein and artery inflammation, and how increased vitamin K can lower the risk of dying over nearly a five-year period from all causes. Well, hey, if I could add 5 years onto my life just by taking some vitamin K, I'm going to do it. From our environmental segment today, I'm going to give you a commentary from Professor Joseph Stiglitz. He won the Nobel Prize. He is a progressive economist. He cares about we the people. In the New York Times, the op-ed page, he had an article entitled On the Wrong Side of Globalization. He tells us why he's opposed to the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Now, this was the first radio program in the United States to take on the Trans-Pacific Partnership. I've done more than 40 programs on it since. We're also opposed to the North Atlantic Treaty, similar to the Trans-Pacific. I've given you my reasons why we should tell our legislators no, not just no on fast-tracking, so the president could make it into law, but no, we don't like this treaty at all. So you'll hear from him. Then, if you remember, it was about 5 years ago, I did a 5 one-hour special on the environment. It was a part of the 12 Tipping Points series. And I said at that time that I'm very concerned that the mathematical models for predicting what could happen are no longer reliable. So things could happen real quick, quicker than we could adapt or get out of harm's way. For example, last week I mentioned that there were strange occurrences in Yellowstone National Park. Herds of buffalo were running down the highway away from the park. Elk were leaving out of the park, and yet this is the time of year when they're migrating from Canada and the northern Rockies into Yellowstone. Now, being a farmer, being a rancher, I live on a ranch now and have for a long time, my entire adult life, I've either lived on a farm or a ranch. And you watch animals, you learn a lot from them, and especially horses. If horses start running around and you don't see any predator, you don't see a bobcat, a mountain lion, a panther, an alligator, if it's in Florida, then, you know, they're feeling something. They have that sixth sense. And that's also true of buffalo. I've actually had an entire herd of buffalo. And they also have that sense. So I thought, okay, it's probably an earthquake. And they're sensing it before it happens. Well, we now know that there was an earthquake, a 5.3 earthquake in California and Los Angeles. But there was also one of 4.5 in Yellowstone National Park. The animals knew it. So what's important is they're the canary in the coal mine. The largest volcano in the northern hemisphere is Yellowstone National Park. In fact, it's been rising slowly up out of the ground. And this was an earthquake, not a volcano. But it's interesting when you kind of predict something and then you see that it comes true because the animals know. Now, in any case, I'm going to give you the latest on the newest NASA study, how the Earth could warm 20% more than any of the earlier estimates. This is from EchoWatch. What that means is that we are in chaos theory. There is no accurate way of predicting anything anymore. No one can predict the hottest or the coldest or the rainiest or the driest or when the water is going to run out or when a hurricane is going to happen or when a tornado is going to happen or when an earthquake is going to happen. All we know is we're now in an area where they are going to happen. Now, for the cynics who say that's not realistic, fact. Today's New York Times front page, the entire top of the page, showed a woman in Bangladesh who was standing where you could see water in the background. And she had lost her home 5 years ago. Now they're saying that millions are losing their home because the oceans are rising. And when the storms happen, they're surging in and wiping out all these people. How many people in the United States live near the ocean and hence would be affected by rising sea levels? Let's see if you can guess. Come within 10 million. And if you can, our number is 888-874-488. Now, this is the topic of the longest documentary I've ever produced. It's called The 12 Tipping Points. And I'm both writing a book on it, a sequel to my first book that was published on the original Earth Day in the United States, of Clearer, Cleaner, Safer, Greener, Blueprint for New Environment. But this is not a happy ending book. Unfortunately, no matter what I do to try to show that we're learning, we're going to prevent, we're going to finally wake up, we're not. We're doing absolutely positively nothing anywhere in any continent to help prevent this from happening. I wish I could say so. Yes, they're developing some eco villages. So what? It doesn't mean anything. They're coming up with some good ideas on wind and solar. Good. But not if they don't stop at the same time using oil and coal. And they're not stopping. And they won't. And we had 125,000 unique weather events in the last 12 months, meaning the worst that's ever happened in world history or American history or since civilization. So if you can't say 125,000 unique events, the coldest, the wettest, the largest tornadoes, the largest hurricanes, then it wouldn't matter what we told you. You're not going to pay attention. But for those of you who are paying attention, I'll be doing a new series in the very near future about what you can do to get out of harm's way. Time permitting today, I also want to talk about homelessness in the United States and how big it is. Let's begin. Of all the sexy vitamins, vitamin K doesn't make the list. Coenzyme Q10, PPQ, Yeah, those are important. Those are hot on a lot of people's minds. They want them. Vitamin K, not so much. But vitamin K can do something others can't. A new study, as published in the Journal of Nutrition, shows, quote, higher intake of vitamin K with a lower risk of dying from any cause over a medium follow-up of 4.8 years. The study included 7,216 participants in the PREDIMED study, which sought to evaluate the protective effects of the Mediterranean diet against risks of cardiovascular disease in older men and women. And one of the things that was measured was vitamin K1 and K2. What they found that K2 made a big difference, was able to lower death. So you don't need a lot of vitamin K2, like 2 to 3 milligrams, but make sure you get it. Now, we've all heard the notion an apple a day keeps the doctor away, and there's good reason for that, but it's not just the apple. Apple skins are the best part of the apple. So if you take the apple and peel it, then juice it, you're getting the benefit of the polyphenols that are in the juice, in the organic water, that's all good, and the antioxidants, and keep the skins aside. And then you can get like 3 or 4 or 5 apple skins over a day or two, throw them in the blender with some, I would put in maybe some walnuts or pistachios or almonds, and maybe a tablespoon of flaxseed oil, coconut oil, black cumin seed oil, and then maybe some berries. And then blend that up and has that as a mid-morning tonic. It's a terrific tonic. Why? Because the skin of the apple is loaded with healing nutrients. It can lower your cholesterol, lower blood pressure, kills bacteria. It's terrific for you. But as good as that is, now we can add peaches. Now, we all love a peach. One of the things I miss every year is if I'm not at my ranch, because I grow peaches. And just to go out there before the birds get them. And the birds know when all fruit's ripe by their color. A bird won't peck at anything that's not ripe. But the moment, the day that that gets ripe, there they go. That's why you should always throw a fish net with a tiny little netting over your fruit trees. Cherry trees, peach trees are particularly vulnerable to the birds. So in any case, then at least you can eat them. But a lot of times I'm on the road. Last year I missed all the grapes. I grow grapes and I love going out just picking grapes. Well, if you can grow peaches, and in most of the altitudes you can, from Florida to Canada, you can grow peaches. Here's one more reason why. This is from Washington State University and published in the Peer Review Journal of Nutritional Biochemistry. Quote, food scientists at Texas A&M and Washington State University found that compounds in peaches can inhibit the growth of breast cancer cells and their ability to spread, that's metastasize. The primary killer in breast and many other cancers is metastasis. Well, the compounds in peaches help interfere in this process. They're saying 2 to 3 peaches a day. Quote, I would do 3 peaches a day, said the professor of food science. And, quote, having enough fruits and vegetables that can provide these compounds in our diet might have a similar preventative effect. So, one good reason to have peaches, so if it helps people with breast cancer and prevents the breast cancer from metastasizing, then why couldn't we assume it could also help prevent breast cancer? Now, then you're going to say, but Gary, we can't get peaches all year. You know, in the spring, yes, and especially Georgia peaches. Those are the best I've ever found in America. And by the way, there's a way of knowing that a peach is ripe. Hold it in your hand. And a really good peach will be soft at the bottom. That's where the natural water and sugars collect. And if it's not really full, and if you don't feel that soft bottom part, it's not ready yet. And when they say that it's been in the sun, it's ripened in the sun, vine ripened or tree ripened, that's the best. Otherwise, the commercial ones you find in your supermarkets, even in most health food stores, they have been picked before they're red. And then the enzymes that occur through photosynthesis are not there. Therefore, you're not going to get the high quality natural sweetness that you otherwise would. And then when you're looking at peaches, feel them. They should give gently to the thumb. So if it doesn't give, it's too hard. And all that's going to happen is going to be mealy. So it's just a suggestion. But you can get frozen organic peaches, and they were... And let me explain how this is done and why sometimes frozen peaches are better than even what we call fresh peach. The best peach is when you go out and pick it off the branch. Same with cherries, same with apples, oranges. But we all can't do that. And they're not always in season. But when peaches are ripe, they're harvested, taken into a building, washed, and then cut, the stone is taken out, and then they're flash frozen. Then when they're thawed, they have that sweetness and that freshness. So frozen peaches are all right also. You've heard me mention many times that we should be having oil. Now, there's two ways of getting the oil. One is through fish. The other is through flaxseed or walnut oil or hemp oil. There are many different benefits to the omega-3s, and you can get them in different forms. This is the latest study from Columbia University Medical Center. Here's what it says. This was published in PLOS ONE, a major scientific publication. Quote, fish oil may help protect the brain after stroke. Triglyceride lipid emulsions rich in the omega-3 fatty acids injected within a few hours of an ischemic stroke can decrease the amount of damaged brain tissue by 50% or more in mice. So that's important. So my suggestion, if you know anyone who has had a stroke, make sure they get hyperbaric oxygen therapy, but also the omega-3 fatty acids. Mulberries are delicious. They generally get anywhere from a half inch to sometimes as long as 2 inches. You want them not when they're red. You want them when they're black or dark purple. And I like to eat them some fresh, but then drying them overnight at 110 degrees preserves all their nutrients. Nothing is lost. And then they're good. Throw them in a bag and put them in the refrigerator. They're good for 2 years. Throw them in a freezer. They're good indefinitely. But they're really good for you. But they're seasonal. Here's the latest on mulberries. So you could get the dried mulberry, and it's good. This is from Case Adams, Green Med Info. Clinical research from Thailand University has confirmed that the ancient herb mulberry leaf significantly curbs inflammation among the arteries, lowers triglycerides, and reduces the LDL levels. And it stays that way for months. So, we all know that behind a lot of diseases is inflammation. So if we want to help tamp down that inflammation, which can lead to stroke and heart attack and diabetes and cancer, then the mulberry leaf, and mulberry leaves you can get in any health food store. And also lowers your C-reactive protein, liver enzymes. That's good for people with cirrhosis of the liver and hepatitis. And it impacts in a positive way your glutathione, which we want. We want a lot of glutathione. So that's good. Also, vitamin E slows cognitive decline in Alzheimer's disease. This is new research that was done at the Veterans Administration and Yale University School of Public Health. and they found that, quote, vitamin E can slow cognitive decline among mild to moderate Alzheimer's disease patients. I would suggest a full-spectrum vitamin E that has the tocotrienols and tocopherols. Quote from the study, elevated levels of tocopherol, that's vitamin E, and tocotrienols are associated with reduced risk of cognitive impairment in older adults. That's so easy to take. I mean, it's just a vitamin each day to prevent what we now have at epidemic levels, cognitive decline. Now, nice to have you with us. I'm going to be going to your calls in just a moment. Our call number is 888-874-4888, 888-874-4888. But I promised you a more in-depth analysis of vitamin K2. I'm going to share some information from William Davis Medical Doctor. Now, we all want healthy bones and, of course, healthy arteries. Interesting, I was just coming across to the studio here on the Upper West Side of Manhattan. I always get a juice before the show. And someone said, hey, Gary. I said, hi. I want to introduce you to my brother. I said, hi. Yeah, he just had a heart attack, and he was exercising, and they have a stent. And I said, how old are you? He said, I'm 49. And I said, well, it wasn't the exercise that caused the heart attack. It was what you've been eating or drinking up to that moment. And he's, well, you know, I never paid attention to it. My brother's, you know, big listener to your program, but I'm not. And I just didn't think there was anything to it, but now I got to look at it. It's amazing how many people take for granted their health until the reality of a heart attack or a stroke. Millions of people take calcium supplements, which is a good thing to protect their bones. Yet few patients realize that optimizing bone integrity involves more than taking a single mineral. I'm willing to bet if I ask most people, what do you do for your bones? Calcium. What about magnesium? Boron? Manganese? Vitamin B, K2? Phosphorus? Silica? They wouldn't know. All those are important, along with vitamin D3. Well, vitamin K both helps your bones and cardiovascular health. In fact, recent research has revealed that without vitamin K2, calcium regulation is disrupted. In fact, low levels of vitamin K2 are associated with an increased risk of heart disease and atherosclerosis. So astute doctors have long known that people with a lack of calcium in their bones are more likely to possess an excess of calcium in their arteries and vice versa. The resulting lack of calcium in bone leads to osteoporosis, while the depositing of calcium in the arterial wall leads to coronary heart disease and other manifestations of cardiovascular and renal and neurodegenerative disease. Now, we've known for a long time that vitamin K is important, but generally gets no attention. People think, oh, vitamin K, yeah, that's important for blood clotting. Yes, it is. But it's also important for your bones and arteries. Now, the key is this. You don't need a lot of it, but osteoporosis and heart disease, they are connected. On the surface, they do share a few common features. Both conditions develop as you get older. It's rare for someone to have either condition at age 30, but both are common in the 50s, 60s, and 70s years of life. Both conditions don't develop overnight, but require many years to emerge. Just as osteoporosis requires decades to develop, coronary atherosclerosis also accumulates bit by bit over decades, generally starting when a person is in their teens. And in fact, as long ago as the 19th century, scientists knew that an unknown material lining diseased arteries resembles a bone-like structure. And for the next 100 years, this finding was dismissed as a curiosity, an inevitable accompaniment of aging, of wear and tear, just like arthritis. But that's not the case. We've unraveled that curious connection by successfully identifying a protein in human atherosclerotic tissue, which was previously believed to reside only in bone tissue. And this protein, called bone morphogenic protein 2 plays an important role in bone formation. Since then, several other key regulators of bone formation have been identified in atherosclerotic plaque tissue, such as matrix GLA protein and osteopontin, suggesting that common factors might influence both artery and bone health. In nature, vitamin K is found in two forms. It's found in K1 in leafy green vegetables and K2 in organ meats, egg yolk, and dairy products. Vitamin K is required for the liver to manufacture blood clotting proteins. Factors 2 and 7 and 9 and 10. And this is the basis for administering the vitamin K blocking drug Werfen or Coumadin to people who have blood clots or at risk for blood clot formation, since clot formation is effectively suppressed by the drug. And so beyond its role in blood clotting, recent research shows that vitamin K plays an essential role in healthy bones and arteries by keeping calcium in the bones and out of your arteries. So make sure that you're getting your vitamin K, too, each day. Now, before we go to your calls, commentary from Professor Joseph Stiglitz, who won the Nobel Prize. This was printed in the New York Times last week, the op-ed page. And I'm sharing this because all of us in this audience, I know, are opposed to the Trans-Pacific Partnership, because it's like NAFTA on steroids, and it would destroy our sovereignty. Unlike those on the historic left or the right, or the corporate left and right, I'll say, many people who are independent and progressive, they care about the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. And there is such elitism, there is such narcissism by many on the left and the right that, well, you know, what's the big deal? Well, the big deal is that these treaties would take it away. And they're doing nothing, absolutely nothing. So we should. Here's why. From Joseph Stiglitz. Quote, "The Great Divide is a series about inequality. Trade agreements are a subject that can cause the eyes to glaze over, but we should all be paying attention. Right now, there are trade proposals in the works that threaten to put most Americans on the wrong side of globalization. The conflicting views about the agreements are actually tearing at the fabric of the Democratic Party, though you wouldn't know it from President Obama's rhetoric. In his State of the Union address, for example, he blandly referred to, quote, new trade partnerships that would create more jobs. Most immediately at issue is the Trans-Pacific Partnership, or TPP, which would bring together 12 countries along the Pacific Rim in what would be the largest free trade area in the world. Negotiations for the Trans-Pacific Partnership began in 2010 for the purpose, according to the United States Trade Representative, of increasing trade and investment through lowering tariffs and other trade barriers among participating countries. But the Trans-Pacific Partnership negotiations have been taking place in secret, forcing us to rely on leaky drafts to guess at the proposed provisions. At the same time, Congress introduced a bill this year that would grant the White House filibuster-proof fast-tracking authority, under which Congress simply approves or rejects whatever trade agreement is put before it, without revisions, without amendments. Controversy has erupted, and justifiably so. Based on the leaks and the history of agreements in past trade pacts, it is easy to infer the shape of the whole Trans-Pacific Partnership, and it does not look good. There's a real risk that it will benefit the wealthiest sliver of the American and global elite at the expense of everyone else. The fact that such a plan is under consideration at all is testament to how deeply inequality reverberates through our economic policies. Worse, agreements like the Trans-Pacific Partnership are only one aspect of a larger problem, our gross mismanagement of globalization. Let's tackle the history first. in general, trade deals today are markedly different from those made in the decades following World War II, when negotiations focused on lowering tariffs. As tariffs came down on all sides, trade expanded, and each country could develop the sectors in which it had strengths, and as a result, standards of living would rise. Some jobs would be lost, but new jobs would be created. Today, the purpose of trade agreements is different. Tariffs around the world are already low. The focus has shifted to non-tariff barriers, and the most important of these, for the corporate interest-pushing agreements, regulations. Huge multinational corporations complain that inconsistent regulations make business costly, but most of the regulations, even if they are imperfect, are there for a reason, to protect workers, consumers, and the economy and the environment. What's more, those regulations often were put in place by governments responding to the democratic demands of their citizens. Trade agreements, they boost euphemistically claims that they are simply, they want to harmonize regulation. That's a clean-sounding phrase that implies an innocent plan to promote efficiency. One could, of course, get regulatory harmonization by strengthening regulations to the highest standards everywhere. But when corporations call for harmonization, what they really mean is a race to the bottom. When agreements like the Trans-Pacific Partnership govern international trade, when every country has agreed to similarly minimal regulations, multinational corporations can return to the practices that were common before the Clean Air Act, before the Clean Water Act became law in the 1970 and 72 respectively, and before the latest financial crisis hit. Corporations everywhere may well agree that getting rid of regulations be good for their corporate profits. Trade negotiators might be persuaded that these trade agreements would be good for trade and corporate profits, but there would be some big losers, namely everyone else, the rest of us. These high stakes are why it is especially risky to let trade negotiations proceed in secret. All over the world, trade ministries are captured by corporate and financial interest. And when negotiations are secret, there's no way that the democratic process can exert the checks and balances required to put limits on the negative effects of these agreements. The secrecy might be enough to cause significant controversy for the Trans-Pacific Partnership. What we know of its particulars only makes it more unpalatable. One of the worst is that it allows corporations to seek restitution in an international tribunal, not only for unjust expropriation, but also for alleged diminution of their potential profits as a result of deregulation or regulation. This is not a theoretical problem. Philip Morris Cigarettes has already tried this tactic against Uruguay, claiming that its anti-smoking regulations, which have won accolades from the World Health Organization, unfairly hurt profits, violating a bilateral trade treaty between Switzerland and Uruguay. In this sense, recent trade agreements are reminiscent of the Opium Wars, in which Western powers successfully demanded that China keep itself open to opium because they saw it as vital in correcting what otherwise would be a large trade imbalance. Provisions already incorporated in other trade agreements are being used elsewhere to undermine environmental and other regulations. Developing countries pay a high price for signing on to these provisions, but the evidence that they get more investment in return is scant and controversial. And though these countries are the most obvious victims, the same issue could become a problem for the United States as well. American corporations could conceivably create a subsidiary in some Pacific Rim country, invest in the United States through that subsidiary, and then take action against the United States government, getting rights as a foreign company, even though they're an American company doing business on a foreign island, and then that they could get reimbursed. Again, this is not just a theoretical possibility. There is already some evidence that companies are choosing how to funnel their money into different countries on the basis of where their legal position in relation to the government is strongest. There are other terrible provisions. America has been fighting to lower the cost of health care, but the Trans-Pacific Partnership would make the introduction of generic drugs more difficult and thus raise the price of medicines. In the poorest countries, this is not just about moving money to corporate bank accounts. Thousands would die unnecessarily. And of course, those who do research have to be compensated. That's why we have a patent system. But the patent system is supposed to carefully balance the benefits of intellectual protection with any worthy goal, making access to knowledge more available. I've written before about how the system has been abused by those seeking patents for the genes that predispose women to breast cancer. The Supreme Court ended up rejecting those patents, but not before many women suffered unnecessarily. Trade agreements provide even more opportunities for patent abuse. The worries mount. One way of reading the leaked negotiation documents suggests that the Trans-Pacific Partnership would make it easier for American banks to sell risky derivatives around the world, perhaps setting us up for the same kind of crisis that led to the Great Recession. In spite of all this, there are those who passionately support the Trans-Pacific Partnership and agreements like it, including many economists. What makes this support possible is bogus, debunked economic theory, which has remained in circulation mostly because it serves the interests of the wealthiest. Free trade was a central tenet of economics in the discipline's early years. Yes, there were winners and losers, the theory went, but the winners can always compensate the losers so that free trade is a win-win. This conclusion, unfortunately, is based upon numerous assumptions, many of which are simply wrong. And that's part of what he had to say. Now, just to show you how accurate he is, this is a piece from the latest information that we have. I mentioned this past week about how it was $1,000 for one single pill for hepatitis. And then I gave you an example of how you could go about helping someone with hepatitis for pennies. Quote, big pharma profiteering gone wild. $1,000 a pill hepatitis drug sells for less than $10 in Egypt. $1,000 in the United States, the same identical pill, $10 in Egypt. The difference? Because of who they paid off, the politicians they have in their pocket. Our entire Congress is corrupt. The White House is vilely corrupt. And yet people are mindless to the consequences. That's just one consequence. That's what they're getting, 100,000% markup in drugs. That's the way it goes. I'm Gary Knoll. We're here to talk about the issues that make a difference. Back in a moment with your calls. For the remainder of our program, we'll hear what you have to say. 888-874-4888. Please stay with us. Have you with us today? By the way, from our environmental segment, one more mention. I said NASA says that we could expect the planet to become even warmer than any researchers thought in the past. According to the brand new research, Drew Schindel, a climatologist at NASA's Goddard Institute for Space Studies, says the planet could become 20% warmer than previous estimates. Wow. Okay, so it's going to get hot, and water's going to be in short supply. The big wars are going to be over water. In the United States, I predict that within the next 10 years, at least 1,000 communities in the United States and 22 states will not have adequate water or any water whatsoever. And nothing is being done about it. So for those of you who have water or access to good, clean water, that's an investment in the future. That's going to pay off. Let's say hello to Tim from New Jersey. Hi, Tim. Your turn. Tim, your turn. You're up. No, Tim? Then let's go over and say hello to Luann. Hi, Luann.
Hello, Gary. You know, since you've mentioned this on other shows, I've been getting a lot of feedback about this whole issue of genocide, and specifically some people from India have been saying, you know, India has so many wonderful things in it, and, you know, why is Gary focusing on the killing of babies and infants in India? So maybe you can clear this up for the audience. Why are they killing these little babies in India?
Because we're not protesting. The rest of the world is not protesting. We're doing trade with them. And as long as you are doing trade or you have some form of favored a status with a nation, you're likely to overlook what they're doing, that if there was nothing you had to benefit from, you would make important, just like dealing with China. Over 1 million of its own citizens die each year, minimally, from its air pollution. That's a human right issue. Well, you have to balance. They've been on a rip for the last 15 years, growing anywhere from 9 to 13% per year. They've built over 16 phantom cities holding over 60 million people. No one lives there. That's how much money they had. That's how much corruption they were engaged in, where people who were connected to the political stat builders could get money, low-interest money, and then spend it, and everyone along the way took their share of it. Well, now they have a bubble economy. They're the most polluted country in the world. It's unsafe in any of their cities. 16 of the 20 most polluted cities in the world are in China. And they have terrible human rights. They execute more people in China. I believe it's around 5,000 or 6,000 per year than any other country. And they are aggressive. They had, of course, they destroyed over 50,000 of the temples in the Himalayas and also in Tibet, and killed thousands, estimated over 100,000 Tibetans. And yet we continue to do business with them because we benefit from it. We can buy their items cheaply, fill our stores, Walmarts and Kmarts and drugstores. And in turn, we say, okay, we'll give a wink and a nod, but, you know, don't get too far out of line. And at the other end of that, we really don't care who gets hurt. Now let's go to India. India is indeed a beautiful country if you're able to look at it by excluding everything that's not. If you were to walk down the main streets of let's say, Calcutta or some of the other major cities in India, you would see it teeming with people. But also, if you get up early in the morning, you would see the oldest men defecating off curbs, then their sons behind them, then the oldest women, and then the younger women, then finally the children. Why? Because there is at least 700 million people who don't have indoor plumbing, don't have toilets. It's not their fault. They're victims of a system. The largest democracy in the world is also one of the most corrupt and inefficient. Everyone knows the disaster of so much nepotism and corruption in any bureaucracy. Russia has it, China has it, India just happens to have it. And yet you have massive, massive poverty, but interspersed with massive wealth. For example, the most expensive home in the world, and I think the ugliest home ever created. I can't imagine a home where you spend this amount of money and it looks like a car lot. Looks like a parking garage. It's so ugly, but it's right in the midst of this teeming poverty. And that's the weirdness of India. Yes, you have beautiful temples, absolutely. You have wonderful natural scenes, but you also have so much human suffering. And part of it is because they have a caste system. Now, to your specific question, I will continue to raise my voice in protest against what I see as massive genocide. This is not speculative. It is not conspiratorial. Look at the U.S. United Nations Department of Economic and Social Affairs. All right? They state that Indian girl children ages 1 to 5, you are 75% more likely to die than an Indian boy child. That makes it the worst gender differentiation in child death of any country in the world. Well, why? Simple, because the male-female ratio of boys and girls generally favors girls worldwide, most countries. But because girl infants are allowed to live in other countries, not so in there. It is an infanticide. And China and India are the two leading ones. Now, the Indian organization Save the Girl Child has documented 5 million little girls being killed every year.
My God.
UNICEF says 700,000 are selectively killed by abortion by wealthier families that can get ultrasound. The moment you get ultrasound, you see it's a female, it's aborted. Well, that's 700,000. So we've got about close to 6 million per year. But if we take it over the last 20 years, how many millions is that? Luann?
You're not asking me to do math on Sunday.
I would ask. It's 12 million.
Okay.
12 million within our lifetimes. Even a young person lifetime. Well, if a country has caused 12 million deaths, preventable deaths, wouldn't you think that would make it an issue to contend with? Nowhere do you see it written about. In fact, 1 in 6 girls dies due to gender discrimination, and 1 in 12 girls in India will never reach their first birthday.
How do they kill them?
Well, okay. There was a study by Tamil Nadu, by the Community Service Guild of Madras, and they found that female killing is rampant in the state, but only amongst the Hindu. You will not find this in Muslims. You will not find this in Christian families. It's taboo. Or Jewish families, taboo. But they studied 1,250 families. And what they found was 740 of the families said, yeah, we killed our baby girl. They do not consider it controversial. They do not consider it wrong. And why? It's always the mother or the women who commit the infanticide. And it's how they do it is this. When the baby is born, they generally do it one of two ways. They will put a wet cloth over the baby's face and it suffocates. Or they pour dirt or ash into the baby's mouth and it suffocates. Those are the two ways that they're most commonly killed. All right? And then they're just taken out and they're buried. But why would people do this? Why would a mother kill her daughter?
Why would they carry an infant? Why would they carry a baby for 9 months and birth it?
Because they think it may be a boy. And 53% of girls up to 9 years are illiterate in India. And only the state of Kerala, where they have 95 to 100% literate girls. Interesting, that's controlled by a political faction that is more humane. Here's why. And this is a curse against Hinduism that they've accepted. Economic costs on a family having a girl is high and impoverishes families. The problem is also intimately tied to the institution of dowry. Are you familiar with dowries?
Yes, to a degree.
Okay. It's where a family of a prospective bride must pay enormous sums of money, as well as possessions and jewelry and animals and commitments of indebtedness to the family in which the woman will live after marriage. Now, that's not the case elsewhere, and it's actually been banned, but it doesn't matter. It still happens. It's formally outlawed, and the institution is still pervasive. So you have a combination of dowry and wedding expenses usually add up to more than 1 million rupees. And 1 million rupees is how much, Luann?
Oh, here you go again.
Yeah, no. It's $35,000.
That's what I was going to say.
See, I knew it. And in India, the average civil servant earns about 100,000 rupees, and that's about 3,500 a year. So given the figures, combined with the low status of women, it's not so illogical from their point of view that poor Indian families want only male children, because a male child can work. A male child gets the inheritance. A male child will get the land. And abortion allows for a legal way not to have girl infants. But the urban and rural poor cannot afford abortions, so killing the child is common. And also, for a poor family, a son is like an insurance policy. A girl, on the other hand, is perceived as an incurred debt, which even relates to food and health. A poor family struggling to feed itself will favor giving milk products and food to a son and let their daughter starve to death. You see that very common in India. Go into a house, poor family, the boy eats first, the older man eats first, the oldest man eats first, ahead of all the women. And the one that eats the least and last is the littlest girl, if there's anything to eat, but sometimes there's not. In rural India, girl killing is not regarded as a sin. Why? Because the Indian caste system is a fatalist belief system. A person is born due to the past karma from previous lives and the socioeconomic caste conditions of a particular family. And in traditional Hindu belief, a person cannot leave the caste they're born into until after death. And for example, an untouchable caste cannot progress to become a Brahmin or higher caste, or nor vice versa. And past karma determines the caste a person is born into. So death frees a person from his or her caste in this world. Therefore, in a way, girl killing is also seen as freeing the girl from a life of poverty, permitting the Atman, which is the soul, to sojourn to a new and hopefully a new birth into a better socioeconomic caste. And also, Hinduism is wishy-washy about suicide. Consequently, suicide is very high among Hindus, not just among the genetically modified cotton farmers we've talked about on this program. And again, Hinduism offers the possibility of a better rebirth after death. So suicide is one doorway to escape the socioeconomic determinism of caste and karma. And one misconception or misperception about Hinduism is the myth that Hinduism is a unified religion. It is not. The term Hinduism was essentially created by the British, but Hinduism is in fact a multitude of different religions or sects, many of which are theologically antithetical to each other. For example, in some sects, particularly those in more rural and poor communities in areas of eastern India, such as Bengal or Assam, and the northeastern states, goddesses are perceived as wrathful, like Kali or Durga or Tara, which expresses the wrathfulness and harshness and suffering of life. And there is nothing analogous to the Western idea of heaven on earth that provides an incentive to live as a beautiful and fulfilling life. And karma does not promise happiness. It's harsh and mean. And the fatalist metaphysics of being born into a lower caste or as an untouchable doesn't inspire anyone to improve their lives and move beyond their religious belief. And only death provides an escape from socioeconomic suffering. But the history of killing children. We've had sacrifices in Babylonian, pre-Columbian cultures, and Near Eastern groups which sacrificed the firstborn to the gods, like Phoenicians, Canaanites, and Abraham. And it was also common in Neolithic groups in order to keep the population low for having sufficient food. But it's strictly forbidden. It was in ancient Egypt, but not in Greece, not in Roman times, not certainly in Germanic and Scandinavian tribes. They would kill your child if you had a baby out of wedlock. But Judaism, Christianity, and I would say probably, and certainly Jainism, many other groups, including Islam, strictly forbid killing babies. So, that's hopefully that answers the question.
Sure does.
Okay. All the best. I'm Gary Nall. Let's say hello to, is it Aziz from Long Island?
Hey.
Hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. Just want to say thank you first for everything that you do. My question is, my girlfriend has a gluten allergy, and I wanted to see if you have a protocol to try to reverse it.
Well, the best thing for gluten is to get on a gluten-free diet, and then to reestablish healthy gut bacteria, and then to seal any leakages that have happened in the gastrointestinal tract. Your best way of doing that would be to drink sauerkraut juice or cabbage, raw organic cabbage juice, 3 times a day, and then to take anywhere from 5 to 10 billion good probacteria at the same time to recolonize the gut. Glutamine, generally around 3,000 milligrams, helps in that repair mechanism, but also vitamin C and quercetin are important in that as well. And that would be the approach. And then go towards the sprouted grains. And the sprouted grains are always beneficial, even sprouted, sunflower seeds and sprouted pumpkin seeds, which are available in most health food stores. That would be the approach. All the best, TSEs.
Thank you, Greg.
Good. And one last quick one. Let's say hello to Nick from New Jersey. Hi, Nick.
Thank you, Gary, for taking my call, and thank you for all your work. Have you ever worked with aromatic essential oils?
Yes.
Are they supposed to be very beneficial, high on the auric scale?
Not on the auric scale. You don't want to be taking the essential oils for its auric. You want to take the essential oils generally because of the aromatherapy benefits and or because of its application diluted and controlled in a bottle where you might have an infection, worms, parasites, gastrointestinal disturbances, or in the throat if you have bacteria overgrowth, yeast overgrowth, thrush, strep, staph, etc. Those would be the two reasons I would use it. I would not use it for ORAC. All right?
Oh, okay.
All the best to you.
Thank you.
We're out of time. Have a nice day, everyone. Oh.